Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what will Senator Kyrsten Sinema's legacy look like as she exits politics? And the CIA was monitoring Latino students at the U of A who were fighting for civil rights in the 1970s. But first, when President-elect Donald Trump came to Arizona last month to celebrate his win, he announced his support for someone who didn't get it in her bid for governor a few years ago, Karen Taylor Robeson. Then Trump backed Taylor Robeson's GOP primary opponent, Carrie Lake. And at the time, Taylor Robeson didn't want the former president's support. But oh, how the times have changed. She once had called him a drag on the Republican Party, but today Taylor Robeson supports the incoming president, though she's not considered a MAGA Republican. Reaction from GOP hardliners has been mixed, and now questions are swirling about who might run from the Republican side against incumbent Katie Hobbs in 2 years. Our own Cameron Sanchez has been covering it all, and she joins me now to tell us more. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so the new state lawmaker, the new state lawmakers have barely taken office. We're barely starting this new year, but we're already talking about the next election. Yay. Has Robeson even said if she is running yet?
No, but there's no time like the present, and you can't get too much of a jump start on things, I guess. In this case, it seems as if, you know, she has a good shot if she wants to jump into the race. I think pretty much everyone is expecting her to, given that she has this new endorsement, which really opens all these doors for her, because last time, the thing that kind of tanked her campaign is that she had to go against Carrie Lake, and Carrie Lake had that MAGA wing of the party. But now, if Karen Taylor Robeson already has it in the bag, or at least Trump and his support, then she'll be walking in with a really nice advantage.
Tell us more about Karen Taylor Robeson. She ran for that nomination a few years ago as a more kind of centrist, traditional, middle-of-the-road Republican, lost to, as you said, MAGA, you know, acolyte Carrie Lake in 2022. Tell us more about her.
Well, she's been around forever, and she's known for being a somewhat wealthy and influential person in the Valley. And I believe her father was the head of the state Senate at one point. He was also on the Corporation Commission. She had a big real estate business, and I believe her brother was also on, I think, the Board of Supervisors. So a lot of experience staffing for politicians and being in that world, et cetera. So when she ran, you know, she had the support of sort of that wing of Republicans, people you might expect, not the MAGA wing of the party. Mm-hmm. And of course, going up against Carrie Lake, we all remember who Carrie Lake is and who would be in her corner. And it turned out that Carrie Lake won, and she had to go up against Katie Hobbs. And then, of course, Katie Hobbs beat Carrie Lake. And then, of course, once again, Carrie Lake ran for something and she didn't make it. Now she's been tapped by Trump. She intends to lead Voice of America. So she's kind of moved on. And now we're looking at who else is going to be running for governor in 2026. That's the big question. That's the biggest position available, right? Karen Taylor Robeson, even though she hasn't announced that she's running, she did thank Trump for the endorsement, and she did say something supportive about him, which is a break from the past, because not only did he endorse Carrie Lake, but she was endorsed by Mike Pence, and she endorsed Mike Pence a few years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So what does this say about the sort of takeover, the MAGA takeover of the Republican Party here in Arizona? Is Taylor Robeson still representative of that more traditional business-friendly branch of the GOP?
I guess we'll have to wait and see what she does, because typically during campaign season, we have to watch and see, you know, what are people doing and how are they adjusting themselves to make sure they're getting all the votes that they need. I also wonder, on the other side of that, does it mean that the MAGA wing of the party is more willing to work with the other kinds of Republicans? Does it mean that Trump is making more of an effort to do that? Because presumably someone talked to him and said, hey, we think this person has a shot at winning. You should really consider endorsing her. And that's how we got to this point, which was not something that all of the Freedom Caucus and all the MAGA Republicans loved, by the way. I mean, there was plenty of pushback to the idea of Karen Taylor Robeson getting his endorsement, people calling her a rhino and a swamp creature on social media.
Right, right. So some pushback from Trump loyalists to this endorsement. What about some of the other Republicans who have expressed interest or at least been rumored to be thinking about running for governor next time around? We've got names out there being floated like Congressman Andy Biggs or Turning Points Charlie Kirk.
I saw that Kirk and Biggs specifically were completely silent about it, but I heard that other Republicans like Jake Hoffman were more vocal in their frustration. And Jake Hoffman is another name I've heard that he could be possibly interested in running for governor. But, you know, it makes it a lot harder if your opponent already has the Trump endorsement to go up against that person if you're in the MAGA wing of the party, because that's the vote you're trying to get is mm-hmm. the Trump supporters, right? And if Trump supports someone else, then what are you telling those people? But keep in mind, you know, it's still so early that Trump could change his mind, or he could even double endorse, which sounds like a weird concept, but he's done it in the past.
Yes, he has. So what chance, I mean, a couple years out here, so, you know, everything can change, obviously, but what chance does a Republican candidate have against Katie Hobbs coming up? Like, Katie Hobbs won very narrowly back in 2022 on sort of a centrist ticket as well. Is there a sense among Republicans that Taylor Robeson would have won if she had been the one up against Katie Hobbs in that general election?
I've definitely heard that suggested. I think Katie Hobbs is vulnerable to being taken out. I think she's been in for a few years. The Republicans have been watching her and working hard against her. And I think that they're building a long campaign of anti-Katie Hobbs sentiment and campaign signs, campaign slogans, campaign fodder. So I think that Republicans are maybe well-positioned, especially right. considering this last year's results.
Yeah, we'll leave it there for now. Cameron Sanchez with KJZZ's Politics Desk. Cameron, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And now let's take a trip back in time to the 1960s and 70s, when Latino activists were fighting for equal rights, education, and against police brutality and the Vietnam War. Documents newly released by the CIA confirm long-held suspicions that the federal government was monitoring their activities, sometimes even disrupting them. And their surveillance included an agreement with the University of Arizona to monitor students who were making demands for classes on Mexican-American studies. They even had undercover agents infiltrate some student groups. Axios's Russell Contreras is covering it all, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Russell.
Good morning.
Tell us first where these documents came from. Like, why is the CIA releasing them now?
Well, the document release came at the request of Representatives Joaquin Castro out of Texas and Jimmy Gomez out of California. They asked the CIA and the FBI a few weeks ago to release us documents related to any monitoring or dissemination of information or disruption of activities of Latino civil rights groups in the 1960s and 70s. And Congressman Castro in particular has been very vocal about why this needs to be released. His mother, Rosie Castro, was an activist in the 1960s and 70s, and files showed that the FBI was monitoring her. So he has a very deep interest in wanting to do that, and he felt that if this information was released, it would tell a very different story about what the federal government did to try to disrupt Latino civil rights.
That's so interesting. Tell us more about what the documents reveal. Like, how expansive was this surveillance by the CIA of these groups? It was called Operation Chaos.
That's right, Operation Chaos. So the CIA released these documents in late December, deep into their website. And it appears that the CIA was monitoring Mexican-American and Puerto Rican civil rights activists across the country, more particularly in Arizona, Colorado, and California, according to the first document dump that we have. They were monitoring farm worker leader Cesar Chavez, and Corky Gonzalez, the Denver-based activist. In the case of Cesar Chavez, they were monitoring him just to see if he was going to go to an event honoring the late Martin Luther King Jr. There was an event in New York on the third year anniversary of his assassination. For whatever reason, they were monitoring to see if he would go. In the case of Corky Gonzalez, they were monitoring him because he was being very vocal about Chicano nationalism and fighting police brutality. Whatever the reason was, they were monitoring him because they felt that he was a particular threat in organizing Mexican Americans.
Remind us a little bit about the history here. Like, what kinds of things these activists were doing at the time? I think we know a lot about Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights movement, but maybe less about something like the Chicano movement.
That's right. The Chicano movement came right after the Black civil rights movement and the Mexican American civil rights movement, where those that generation was fighting within the system. The Chicano movement was like the Black Power movement. They wanted to fight outside the system. They were invested in nationalism, pride, even the formation of wanting a particular set of land. They were making radical demands and fighting against the Vietnam War, for example. They were coming across a lot of things. And for whatever reason, the CIA saw that as a threat. They thought that that was just too disruptive, that they were going even further than the civil rights goals. Like the Black Power movement, the Chicano movement was invested in a lot of indigenous pride. That was very threatening to those in power at the time.
Very interesting. What else do we know about the monitoring of students at the University of Arizona from these documents?
Well, the documents show that the CIA and the University of Arizona had some sort of agreement. It's unclear what kind of agreement, but the CIA's cables report that, look, the University of Arizona is conservative and its administration is promising that they will keep monitoring students making demands of what they call Latin American studies. Well, it appears that the students wanted more Mexican American studies classes. The CIA says in this cable that the University of Arizona is promising not to further research into Latin American studies. So there was some sort of pushback. This, I don't think, is widely known that the CIA and a university were working in cahoots so deeply like this. So if you were going to school in the University of Arizona in the 1970s, more than likely you were getting spied on and monitored to see what your activities were doing. For whatever reason, they were monitoring these students and members of the Brown Beret. They were a radical group at the time.
Did the U of A have any comment on this today, on the release of these documents exposing this?
Well, I did ask the University of Arizona spokesperson. They did say, look, we confirmed that we got your email, and if we have a comment, we'll let you know. So far, we haven't heard anything.
And the representatives who got these documents released have also sought records from the FBI. Those records have yet to be released. Is that right?
That's right. Congressman Castro, I've talked to his office. I said, look, the FBI has not released the documents. They suspect that there's a trove of information. We know that the FBI has worked. We're monitoring like the works of our earlier civil rights leaders like Hector P. Gonzalez or Hector P. Garcia, the Puerto Rican Young Lords Party, and you know later members of the Chicano movement. They were monitoring Jose Angel Gutierrez and Dolores Huerta. They always saw these people as threats because they were fighting not just economic justice, but discrimination. And for whatever reason, if J. Edgar Hoover thought any sort of fight against discrimination, any kind of attempts to upheave the white supremacy or Jim Crow, in this case, Jim Crow with the sombrero, was a threat to the United States and could be communist inspired. Wow. We know that's not true, but for whatever reason, the FBI believed that at the time.
Right. Yeah, we'll leave it there for now. Axios' Russell Contreras joining us with more on this story. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how Tucson's beloved EG's is resurrecting its business practice. But first, Kyrsten Sinema is officially a former senator from Arizona. And when she made her final speech in Washington recently, she highlighted her record as a bipartisan broker.
What I've tried to demonstrate in these 6 years is you don't have to burn down the rules and the norms to achieve what you want. You can just do the hard work. You can build relationships. You can choose to focus on consensus, not division.
Sinema has been something of an enigma in Arizona politics for decades. The former social worker and progressive state legislator rose through the ranks to be elected to the Senate as a centrist Democrat in 2018. Once she got to Washington, she made a habit of bucking her party, finally officially leaving it to become an independent in 2022. She made a name for herself in Washington as an aisle-crossing dealmaker who was willing to take the heat even when she was being skewered by her former party. Case in point, her refusal, along with former Senator Joe Manchin, to grant Democrats' wish to weaken the filibuster, the 60-vote threshold for getting most bills through the Senate, that Democrats will likely rely on as Donald Trump and the GOP take control of Washington this year. Last year, she announced she would not seek re-election as an independent. Arizona Congressman Ruben Gallego took her seat last week. Sinema is not known for her willingness to talk to the press, but she did give an exit interview to our next guest. Burgess Everett is Congressional Bureau Chief for Semaphore and covered Congress for Politico before that. I spoke with him before more about what Sinema had to say upon her exit from Washington and from politics, beginning with that contentious vote on the filibuster.
She said that it was the most important vote she took in her life to protect the legislative filibuster. As you might recall, about 3 years ago, Democrats were considering kind of weakening the filibuster and letting a voting bill come to the Senate floor under a majority vote, kind of oversimplifying it there. But that was what was going to happen. And she believes real strongly in that 60 vote threshold. And so that was a really important moment for her. And it seems to be the one that she grasped onto the most as she kind of reflected on her service. But I will also say that that vote is actually going to end up helping her former party. Her and Joe Manchin kind of stood against the tide there. And now Democrats are in the minority and they're almost certainly going to be wielding the legislative filibuster in the coming days. I'm not sure exactly how this vote is going to go, but there's going to be a vote on an immigration related bill on Friday. And if Democrats don't give the Republicans 8 votes, they'll use the filibuster to stop it. So it's all coming full circle pretty quickly.
Pretty quickly is right. Sinema often had this uniquely powerful position because she was bipartisan, right? Like, she ran as a bipartisan kind of deal maker. She had friends across the aisle. She was very proud of that. Do you think that that made her more impactful in some decisions like this, where she was willing to buck her party at the time?
Certainly. I mean, I think there's two key attributes here. One is it's not just lip service. Like, I'm someone who will go out, I will sit on the Senate floor sometimes and just see what's going on out there. And she would often be out there, even when she was a very junior senator. I know she only served one term, but, you know, just a few months into her service, she was out there hanging out with the Republicans more than the Democrats. And you might say, you know, why does that matter? Why do we care about that? Well, there were situations where they were just trying to do simple things like line up votes to fund the government or legislation like that, like pretty basic nuts and bolts stuff. And she would help negotiate how to do that by, like, essentially triangulating between the Republican and Democratic caucuses. That's a pretty unique role. And the second part of that is, I think those relationships are one thing. And the other thing she was willing to do is just take heat from the outside world in a way that most modern senators don't want. You know, you see folks who might say something semi-critical, for example, of a Trump nominee on the Republican side, and they get filleted over it and they don't want to talk about it anymore. I think Sinema kind of embraced the ability to stand strong and not move, even when you're kind of getting torched by people that were, you know, when she was a Democrat, by her own party. That's a pretty rare attribute in politics. And I think that made Republicans and even some Democrats respect her more, because not everyone's willing to tolerate that level of abuse.
Yeah. Yeah. What did she say were some of her major accomplishments from her point of view? I mean, there was movement on gun safety. The CHIPS Act is a big deal. What stood out in her mind?
I think to her, infrastructure was probably the big one, because it was sort of the agenda setter on this bipartisan kick that the Senate got on. To her, like, the process mattered. She wanted to show that, you know, you can still do big things with the filibuster in place. Now, there's one counter argument to that, which is that immigration bill that she negotiated a year ago with James Lankford, a Republican from Oklahoma, and Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, that went down because Donald Trump didn't like it. He wanted the campaign issue and Republicans all turned on it. And I do think that kind of left a sour taste in her mouth when it came to that. That's kind of the one that got away. Mm-hmm. We'll see if some pieces of that bill come back in the coming days.
And I wanted to ask you about that particular bill, because she announced, you know, she's not going to run for re-election not long after that deal was sunk by now President-elect Trump. I wonder, like, what do you think this proves or maybe disproves about her thesis here, which is that, like you're saying, like, you can be successful in governing across the aisle, that we could negotiate, we can be bipartisan, that is more effective. Did she prove that?
I think on a bunch of issues she did. I think on the immigration one, I asked her directly, you know, was this a factor in your decision not to run again? And she said it wasn't. But to me, it was hard to see. It didn't at least kind of like sour her a little bit on the institution and politics, or maybe offer some validation to her previously made decision to not run again. I just think there's sometimes like a limit to how much you can do. And frankly, like, I've covered politics quite a while now. I've seen a lot of fits and starts on infrastructure and on gun legislation. And I was definitely somebody that was very skeptical that the gun safety bill would ever be able to pass, for example.
Right.
And so that was a little bit of a paradigm shift to see somebody say that we can do it and then actually do it. So the fact that she kind of met reality and obstruction from the other party on a different piece of legislation, I don't think totally detracts from the other things that she was able to accomplish.
What do you think that says or will say, I guess, when the history books are written about her legacy? Like, how might she be remembered?
I mean, I think there's a reason she says the filibuster is her most important vote. I think that's probably the most enduring at the moment thing that she did, because what, you know, people forget about legislation, it expires, it gets rewritten by the other party and gets tweaked as time goes on. But I do think, like, at the moment and for the foreseeable future, her and Senator Manchin's filibuster vote will be kind of the touchstone for that debate. You know, these two stood up to that. Like, you could totally see a situation where Donald Trump wants Republicans to kill the filibuster, and who's willing on the Republican side to stand up the same way that they were. It's easy to say that you're going to do it, but then in the moment when you're getting crushed online by an army of Trump allies, you know, will you be able to stand strong and continue that? And she and Senator Manchin were able to do that. And I think that's probably going to be the enduring thing, but also that, like, you know, she didn't do what she was doing for electoral reasons. You know, Senator Manchin's from a very Republican state. It was easier to explain why he did what he did when it came to cutting down the Democratic agenda. You know, yeah. Arizona's a battleground. It's a purple state. Mark Kelly kind of proved that a more center-left Democrat can win there too. But Senator Sinema didn't care about that. She wanted to do things her way, kind of the politics be damned, which again is pretty rare in Washington.
Given that, do you think that she ever really cared about being reelected? Did she always kind of plan to leave politics after this?
You know, it's easy to kind of look back and say this is definitely what was going to happen. It does seem to me that it was never important to her to get reelected. So I don't know that she planned to only serve one term, but it didn't ever seem to me like winning reelection was top of mind for her. I do think, like, there are some competitive juices though, like, you know, Ruben Gallego announcing a primary challenge to her before she'd made a decision. Like, I do think that probably irked her a little bit, even if she doesn't say it. And she didn't want to talk at all about Ruben Gallego during our interview either.
Right.
So I don't know if she's the type of person that would say, no, I couldn't have won, because I do think, you know, in her mind, she's a formidable politician as well.
Mm. Did she tell you what she is planning to do next? Lots of speculation about that.
She told me she's made a decision, but that she couldn't tell me. Now, part of that might have been because she was serving in office during her interview. Now she is not serving in office. So it's possible that that'll come out, you know, any minute.
Any minute. All right, we'll leave it there. Burgess Everett, Congressional Bureau Chief for Semaphore, joining us to talk about Senator Sinema's last interview here. Burgess, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. A new book makes the case for empathy in the prison system. The show's Sam Dingman has the story.
A lot of times when we hear about some horrific crime on the news, we have this thought: how could something like this happen? And often we're asking that question sort of existentially, like, how could we live in a world where something like this happens? But the fact is, the world we live in is usually the reason something terrible happens. People's lived experience is what lays the groundwork for that awful moment when they commit a crime. And most of the time, we don't stop to think about that when we ask that question: how could this have happened? Well, a new book called Imprisoned Minds tries to ask the question a little differently. It's co-authored by Kevin Wright, a criminal justice professor at ASU, and a man named Eric Maloney, who's currently serving a life sentence at a prison here in Arizona. In the book, Eric interviews six fellow incarcerated people about their life stories. He also tells his own story to try to understand who he and his fellow inmates were before they were arrested and convicted. The book is an argument for a correctional system that's informed by an understanding of the traumas that can lead people to commit crimes. Not to excuse those crimes, of course, but to ask the question a little more literally: how could something like this happen? And also maybe to ask a different, more provocative question: what do we mean, really, when we say correctional system? I spoke to Eric and Professor Wright from the prison where Eric is incarcerated, and Eric told me that the seed of this idea was planted pretty much the day he got to prison.
I looked around at this concrete and steel cell, and I'm by myself, and the first thing that popped into my head was, look what you've gotten yourself into. And so I went on this journey and I started reading books. I started to really get into psychology and I found trauma. And when I started to study trauma, the way that trauma researchers and writers describe what we now know as the imprisoned mind is very vague, you know, and it seemed to me that they hadn't experienced the trauma. And so I was able to use my lived experience to understand what they were trying to describe.
Yeah, that makes me think of a really moving sequence from the prologue where you talk about your daughter coming to visit you in prison and realizing that it reminds you of going to visit your own father in prison. Am I following correctly that it was connections like that that started to occur to you as you underwent this study?
Absolutely.
There are so many lines in the prologue that really stuck with me, but one in particular was you write, quote, "self-delusion epitomizes the imprisoned mind." Tell us what you mean by that. What do you think leads to that self-delusion?
Well, when we experience trauma, naturally, our protective self emerges to do what it's supposed to do, and that's to protect you. And so we become reactive because of our protective self. And our protective self, it's an irrational part of ourself that externally looks around to try to find any potential dangers. And those potential dangers can be real or imagined.
I have to say, that's one of the reasons it was so compelling to read your story, because as you explained to us in that essay, as a child, you were exposed on a repeated basis to dangers that there was no rational explanation for. You talk about your house being broken into when you were like 20 months old, I think, and being pushed off a roof and various other incidents of violence that, for me as a reader at least, helped me understand why you might reach the conclusion that you need to defend yourself.
Yeah.
And how that thinking process could lead you to all of a sudden find yourself, as you write about, in a gang or selling drugs or whatever the case may be, carrying a gun.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my first 7 years of my life after that, after the being held hostage, I was a scared kid. And it makes me wonder when I see horrific incidences in the news, my first thought is, what happened to this individual to cause them to feel that this was their only option?
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, let me bring you into the conversation. I know you've been studying these issues for a long time. How much does childhood trauma and psychological damage get talked about in the world of criminal justice? And in particular, when it comes to conversations about rehabilitation and recidivism?
Yeah, it's certainly not enough. And, you know, in full disclosure, I have Eric to thank to really push the idea on me more and more. I mean, I knew it was part of the challenge, but I didn't realize how pervasive it was for people on the inside, that they had these backgrounds, they had these experiences. And, you know, certainly some researchers and people do it better than others. They think about the entire life course and they think about how childhood might be connected to later behaviors. But that's rare. You know, typically, a lot of people will care about kids going through traumatic experiences and worry about what their future might look like. And then when these kids become adults, that's gone.
Eric, at a certain point, you started interviewing fellow incarcerated people about this concept. Those must have been really engaged, emotional conversations, but I can also imagine it wasn't easy always to get people to open up.
One thing you'll find about guys in prison is that they will tell you their whole life story if you just ask them.
Hmm. So can you give me an example of a story that you heard from a fellow incarcerated person that really stuck with you?
So Kid's story was actually the first person that I knew he had to be in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you meet Kid, you know, automatically know that he's an angry individual. But when you start talking to him, it quickly becomes apparent that he has a reason to be angry.
Yeah.
Right. And it wasn't until I really asked him about his upbringing and learned about him finding his mother's body and having to be sent to a mental institution because the people who were in charge of his guardianship didn't have the empathy to sit and say, we need to get this kid some help because of what he's just been through.
Yeah.
It's very telling why, after learning about all this, why he's so angry.
Yeah. Kevin, let me ask you again, you know, as somebody who has looked at these issues from a variety of different angles, when you started to hear these stories yourself, what did you make of it? I mean, did this seem like a new framework in your studies of this? What surprised you about the testimony that these folks gave?
I mean, it's the complexity behind these stories. And, you know, I say quite often in the book that there's not necessarily a new groundbreaking idea here, but there's a new groundbreaking perspective. For so long, it's been about reducing recidivism, reducing the rate at which people come back to prison. And so inherently in that, what you're trying to do is take a so-called criminal and make them not criminal. And again, starts from a standpoint that people on the inside are different than people on the outside. And so what would it look like instead if we just adopted a better than arrival corrections and we wanted people to be better than their arrival to the system? Why would we return people to our communities in a worse shape than when they left them? It doesn't really make any sense. And if they're not leaving, if they've got longer sentences, we should still be investing in those people too, because they're the ones that are surrounding everybody else on the inside. And Eric is a perfect testament to that, of what happens when we invest in somebody and what he can offer for people on the inside and people on the outside.
Well, the book we've been discussing is Imprisoned Minds, Lost Boys, Trapped Men, and Solutions from Within the Prison. And I've been speaking to the authors, Kevin Wright, who is an associate professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at ASU, and Eric Maloney. Thank you both so much for this conversation.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
More Arizona families are opting their kindergartners out of vaccinations. Here in Arizona, Axios reports 8.5% of kindergartners were exempt last school year. That's a whole lot higher than the national average, which sits a little over 3%. Vaccine skepticism has been growing in recent years. And now one of the most famous among them, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., is President-elect Donald Trump's pick to head the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But vaccine skepticism doesn't only come from the far right. In fact, our next guest says the world of online wellness influencers who question the establishment when it comes to health decisions comes from both the right and the left.
On the left, wellness influencers are often moms, or they're like yoga practitioners or spiritual gurus in some way. It might be like, you know, a mom who claims to have healed herself from autoimmune disease by eating naturally and, you know, using natural home products and things like that and eschewing medications, and also is anti-vaccine or is promoting, you know, specific things for raising your kids.
That's Christy Harrison, a journalist, dietitian, and author of the book The Wellness Trap, as well as the Rethinking Wellness newsletter on Substack. She's an expert on this world and told me there's also a wellness archetype that's emerging on the right.
Kind of a more masculine gym bro sort of fitness influencer type who's very into like preparedness and masculinity and virility and sort of wanting to enhance all that through supplements and dietary changes and, you know, time at the gym.
But Harrison says it's getting harder to tell the difference between the two political perspectives on wellness on social media these days. The political horseshoe has become a circle with little space left between far left and far right. They're all anti-establishment now. But it wasn't always that way. In fact, Harrison told me she started her career working in eco-lifestyle magazines in the early 2000s. Back then, it was all left-leaning people who were questioning big agriculture from an environmental point of view. But even then, she told me, she saw echoes of what was to come.
I remember even then we reported on this phenomenon called crunchy cons, which were conservatives who had, you know, organic and free range farms. They shopped local, they homeschooled their kids. They were like, you know, more like back to the land hippies than conventional conservatives at the time, who were more in favor of, you know, big business and big agriculture and things like that. And I looked back at this crunchy con manifesto recently because I was like remembering that this had been a thing. And there's something in there that really stands out today, which is big business deserves as much skepticism as big government. Hmm. And I think we're seeing that now, you know, that sort of crunchy con ethos is really taking over on the right more too.
So I can see the way that those two worlds have overlapped and intertwined in recent years. But talk a little bit about where this came from. Like, how did COVID play into this and the kind of mandates that surrounded the pandemic? As you mentioned, this goes back, you know, decades, but I'm imagining that more recently the social media phenomenon and the pandemic might have played a role.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it does go back decades. You know, on the left, there's the wellness movement sort of dating back to the 60s and 70s with hippie culture and organic food and alternative medicine and all that. And then that sort of crunchy con phenomenon actually emerged, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. There was sort of some convergence of left and right around that. But I think with COVID, it really supercharged this anti-establishment perspective that people had and this like questioning of the conventional healthcare system, of public health. You know, there were some real botched messaging about masks, for example, in the early days of saying, you know, don't wear masks and save the masks for the essential workers, right? And then it came out, oh no, masks are actually important, and specifically N95s, not just these homemade cloth things. And then you started to have, you know, questioning of mask mandates. And I think with the right, you know, there's always been this sort of personal freedom argument that's more salient, right? It's like they're trying to take away our freedoms. You know, the government's trying to make us into sheep and make us do what they want. And, you know, we need to resist that and we need to like take back our agency and our freedom, right? Mm-hmm. You know, left wing wellness, I think, is also very much about personal freedom and personal choice as well. And so, you know, it involves more like the choice to opt out of conventional systems, to go against big food and big pharma and choose more, you know, things that are perceived as more holistic, wholesome, natural foods and medicines. So, like alternative medicine and modalities that are perceived as ancient and non-Western, even if they are really co-opted and culturally appropriated, right? And so that side too is very anti-establishment. And I think there's a real like personal health, personal responsibility streak even on the left. So I think the environment was just so ripe for this kind of amalgamation to happen where the left and the right are sort of out there on the fringes now. And now what was so fringe is becoming more mainstream, you know, this sort of anti-science, anti-establishment view of health.
So let's talk then about where we are now, right? Like this moment is such an interesting moment to talk about this spectrum of sort of misinformation on both sides. Where does somebody like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his supporters fit into this spectrum?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because RFK Jr. kind of symbolizes the meeting of those two sides in a lot of ways. You know, he was historically a Democrat, but he's always, you know, for a long time has embraced conspiracy theories about vaccines. So I think his switch over to MAGA world and, you know, being embraced by the right, you know, I think his point of view and sort of conspiracist beliefs about vaccines and all kinds of other things in wellness culture do fit more naturally with the MAGA movement and with that sort of far right belief in personal freedom and, you know, personal freedom at all costs, I think, really, at the cost of public health, at the cost of science and institutions and all of that.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting to see that, you know, there's this real embrace of like functional medicine people and make America healthy again and getting ultra processed foods out of schools and all of these things that there isn't really good scientific evidence to support. And this turn against processed foods, especially, and thinking about, you know, children's health used to be such a province of the left or of Democrats. And even with, you know, like Michelle Obama, especially her Let's Move campaign and her efforts to improve school food and things like that were criticized on the right as this sort of unjust, you know, interference by government into public life. Mm. Right. And so now we see the same sorts of policies being proposed on the right.
One of the reasons, Christy, this is so complicated, I think, is, well, social media, right? And sort of the misleading nature of what you can read there and who's on it. But also just the fact that, and you mentioned this, that a lot of this is justified skepticism, right? Like, there are problems mm-hmm. with our healthcare system, with ultra-processed foods, things like this. How does that sort of bolster influencers, but also kind of just complicate things for the rest of us?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that conspiracy theories generally always have some grain of truth. And I think with the conspiracy theories that we see around vaccines or other things in the healthcare system, you know, there have been some unfortunate, like genuine conspiracies, right? Like big tobacco's conspiring to cover up evidence that tobacco actually does harm people and cause cancer. So I think people have a justified skepticism. And I will say, as a dietitian, I've looked into the scientific evidence behind a lot of these claims about like food dyes and ultra processed foods and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think the science is definitely not there to support cutting out ultra-processed foods completely or banning these dyes completely. You know, I think there's a lot of nuance to that evidence, but of course, that doesn't sell on social media, right? Nuance and science and truth don't really go very far on social media. And there's actually evidence that, you know, misinformation spreads farther, faster to more people by more people than the truth.
And there's also such an opportunity on social media to sell stuff, right? Like, which is what a lot of these influencers are doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it's a proven, tried and true method to make people feel scared about something, to say, you don't know what's lurking in your food, or this thing is poison and they're not telling you, or, you know, doctors are covering this up. And here, buy my supplement to detox.
Yeah. So let me ask you lastly, Christy, just how it is that we should approach this kind of content, not just on social media, but now, you know, in the mainstream, in the government, in the news, in our public officials.
The biggest thing is just to be incredibly skeptical of anything you see on social media related to health and wellness. And the same with government statements and public health recommendations coming out of the new administration. I can't tell you how many times I've seen a claim in, you know, some alternative medicine or functional medicine person's blog post that's like, you need to cut out gluten because a study found that, you know, gluten causes inflammation via this, this, and this pathway or whatever.
Right, right, right.
And then they'll footnote it and there'll be a link in the footnote that goes to the study.
Which makes it seem legit,
through.
Right?
It makes it seem legit. And most people don't click through because it's like, oh, there's a footnote. There's a study. Looks
good.
That's
good. Yeah.
But take that extra step and click through and you'll often see that it doesn't actually show what it claims to show. Sometimes these are just like, you know, now at this point, I think sometimes AI generated.
Mm. We will leave it there for now. Christy Harrison, a journalist, dietitian, author of the book, The Wellness Trap, and the newsletter on Substack called Rethinking Wellness. Christy, thank you so much for coming on to explain this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. A restaurant near and dear to the hearts of many people in Tucson has filed for bankruptcy. EG's has closed four stores in Tucson and another in Phoenix. Catalina Birch is a reporter for the Arizona Daily Star and has been following the Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing. She spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, more about it. And they started with the place EG's has within the culture of Southern Arizona.
EG's is iconic here. It goes back to the 1970s, and it's one of those places where people who grew up with it and it was a regular part of their life, they will leave Tucson and they will literally have EG's, which is the frozen fruit drink. They will literally have it sent to them, you know, and they'll have it packed in dry ice and sent to them. And the first place they go when they come home is, you know, EG's. I mean, I talk to celebrities who, you know, people who grew up here who have gone on and become celebrities. And whenever they come home, they said the first place they hit is EG's.
So what led to this Tucson icon going bankrupt?
They took over. The company had been locally owned for decades. And then it was sold to a national investor is almost like a midway point. And then another national investor took it over and they bought the EG's back in 2018. And it was this company called 38 North Capital. And they initially, when they bought it, they saw how it had this potential to be a national thing. And so their plan was, they had these grandiose initial plans. Oh, we're going to take this to every place that would have like sort of a Tucson connection. They had been getting a lot of phone calls from people who lived in Iowa and who lived in Vegas and California and New Mexico and Texas who said, oh, I remember EG's, open it here. And it's like, you know, you have 12 people who live in you know, some small town in Texas. You don't necessarily open an EG's there.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was their idea. But what they ended up doing was they decided they would make this mad dash for Phoenix. And, you know, obviously they hadn't read their history because EG's years ago had locations in Phoenix and they failed. They didn't last but maybe 2 or 3 years. There is one EG's, I believe it's still open in Eloy. And that's been open for decades, but, you know, go beyond Eloy. And it was a pretty tough sale for EG's because people didn't know it. They didn't grow up with it, you know, and you know, let's be honest. I mean, a sandwich is a sandwich. That isn't why people would go there. And if you don't have a relationship with the frozen drink, not necessarily going to, you know, at the age of 35 or whatever, adopt that as a thing. But they opened 5 locations in the Phoenix area in literally a year. You know, and it's like, and they were all new builds. And meanwhile, they came into Tucson and they also opened additional stores in Tucson and they closed some stores. They did some strategic closing, which was actually really good. They found that they had stores that were almost like on top of each other. So they were kind of robbing their customer base with these stores so closely related. And so they closed those stores. They also revamped some stores. And you know, at the end of the day, they suddenly looked and, you know, the economy was tanking. You know, this was, you know, we're coming into the pandemic and takeout. Yeah, they're a great takeout place, but, you know, they couldn't keep up with it as well and, you know, make ends meet with all the new locations. And I think in Phoenix, it's catching on, but I don't think it's doing what they had imagined. But I think they just got, they expanded too fast and too much. And then the economy, you know, did its little COVID thing, and we're still catching up with that. And you know, and in the interim, we also are seeing, you know, increased prices in product, and you know, so I mean, it's just really super hard to operate a business and to expand a business when you're looking at all of those other influences. You know, so I think that's what ended up happening.
So what is the company's plan? I mean, I know that you've reported that they are optimistic seemingly about being able to come out the other side of this bankruptcy and be stronger. But what are they saying about what the company's plans are?
They're not at this point. They all that they would tell me was that, you know, we're confident we're going to come out of this bankruptcy in 6 months. And then we're going to change in that 6 months. They were going to, you know, they're looking at ways that they can streamline, that they can change operations, that, you know, that they could rethink the game plan. And so I don't know. I have no inside information. I pressed them on it and they were pretty much, well, you know, those are questions we can't answer until we get through the bankruptcy and all of that. And so I really don't know.
What has the reaction in Tucson been to this particular company declaring bankruptcy?
Shock. You know, because it's one of the, you know, we don't have a lot of quote unquote chain, homegrown chain restaurants. We're, you know, Tucson is very, very into local, hyper local restaurants. Mm-hmm. You know, we would rather have a local restaurant than a national chain. So when this came out, this was pretty shocking. You know, people were like, you know, because I think people look at it and it's like this venerable, old, reliable, you know, neighborhood kind of, you go in there and, you know, Saturday afternoon with the kids after softball practice and have an EG, have some fries. And so I think people were really shocked, you know, and it kind of felt like losing one of their family members in a way.
So you mentioned that the company hasn't really said much about what their plans are, but do you have the sense, or is anybody discussing the possibility of closing more stores? Or are they looking to sort of keep open what they have now and maybe operate from that going forward?
With the CEO, the interim CEO, which I feel so sorry for the guy, he literally walked in the door 2 weeks before they filed bankruptcy.
Oh, wow.
Not a great welcome. One thing he did tell me was, I did ask him specifically, is this it? I mean, are we looking at potential more closures? And he said, at this point, it's status quo. We're not opening. We're not closing. We're going to come out of this on the other end. And we're going to work with what we have and see where we can go from there. You know, their whole anticipation is that this bankruptcy will allow them to come back financially stronger and, you know, be able to weather whatever storms we're facing, economic storms we're facing. So, yeah, at this point, I don't, you know, they've not given any indication that we're going to see any more closures.
That's Catalina Birch, reporter for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.